27th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we are back with another episode, another chapter of The Sign of Four. And I sound completely different because guess what, kids? I'm in the studio today.
Back in studio, Steve. Must feel exciting.
I am excited to be home. It was a great road trip. Those of you who are stuck at home, I really suggest you take all the precautions you can, but get out of the house. It's wonderful. Go. Be alive. Speaking of being alive, Chapter 7 of The Sign of Four is all about all sorts of life, right?
Oh, it's super exciting, Steve. There's a number of things that take place here.
Like what, Chip?
Steve, there is a carriage ride between Mary, Sweet Mary, and Mr. Handsome Watson. We end up meeting Scooby-Doo later on, called Toby, who is a dog that will help solve this mystery. We've got Holmes and Watson both tampering with evidence by crawling through crawl spaces, and then we have a long, long stroll. I think this is the beginning of Lord of the Rings. I could be wrong.
Now. We do get a little bit of Mary time just at the beginning of this chapter with the opening. It's kind of interesting how Mary gets represented here. So we start out, the police had brought a cab with them, and in this I escorted Miss Marston back to her home. After the angelic fashion of women, she had borne trouble with a calm face as long as there was someone weaker than herself to support, and I had found her bright and placid by the side of the frightened housekeeper. In the cab, however, she first turned faint and then burst into a passion of weeping. And so we get this notion of Mary as sort of this strong woman who's able to hold it together if she needs to, but then in the presence of a nice strong man like Watson, she just bursts into tears, right?
They will not see me cry. They will not see me cry.
Right? So this is a very Victorian notion of like what a strong woman looks like. Very similar to Mina Harker from Dracula or any number of, you know, Victorian ladies who are strong, but, you know, when accompanied by a cute boy, they're pretty comfortable letting themselves be a little more passive.
And we've mentioned this before, but in the latest version of Sherlock, she is a much stronger character. She has a whole backstory where she is really a strong character that is not from the original text.
No. Now, there is, I don't know if you guys paused, there's a Zugma in this opening section, and the Zugma is one of my favorite literary figures. It's, my sympathies and my love went out to her, even as my hand had in the garden. You guys know about Zugmas?
No,
you gotta tell me this.
Enlighten us.
It's the best. So the Zugma is where you have one verb that goes with something literal and something figurative. So for example, he broke his window and his heart. You see what I mean?
Ah.
You break something literal and you break his heart. Or he lost his keys and his mind. Right? Yeah. And so here, his sympathy and love go out to her, as does his hand. Right? I love this. And so a couple examples from literature, because sorry, I get excited about Zugmas. So in Star Trek The Next Generation, there's that very famous line, you are free to execute your laws and your citizens as you see fit. Or from Mark Twain, The Adventure of Tom Sawyer, they tugged and tore at each other's hair and clothes, punched and scratched each other's nose, and covered themselves with dust and glory. I love that. So, the Zugma is, you know, is a very 19th century trope.
And it's very subtle. I mean,
isn't it?
That's really good writing, but boy, is that subtle.
Do you feel like now that you know about the Zugma, you're going to try and use more in your everyday conversations?
I absolutely will. I just will become aware of what I'm actually doing. Because it's a very playful way to communicate.
I know. It's just so much fun. And so, and sorry, I felt like that was a real, like, English teacher moment. But it is fun, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yes, Professor. Good job.
I feel smarter now because I can define what I do sometimes.
This show is helping people.
And, of course, this is a love moment where Watson is doubting his ability to proclaim his love for Mary.
Yeah, he is really conflicted here because he is stuck on Doyle's idea of class and wealth is once again on display here. Watson's worried about Mary's newfound wealth. He says, was it fair, was it honorable that a half-pay surgeon would take such advantage of an intimacy which chance had brought about? Might she not look upon me as a mere vulgar fortune seeker? He fell in love with her. Love at first sight, literally. But now she's in line to get this money, and now he's really doubting himself.
Well, Steve, you just didn't give enough William Shatner emphasis on the when the reading, or enough Adam West emphasis. This certainly has that all the passion that you could ever imagine with these types of lines.
You think this is an Adam West Watson moment? Was it fair? Was it honorable?
Was it fair? Was it honorable? That a half-pay surgeon should take such advantage. Oh, come on. You got to do it, Steve. That's how I read it, by the way.
Not exactly how Stephen Fry read it in my version of the book, but all right. Now, but one thing that's interesting. So this is the opening paragraph of the chapter, and then Mary is never mentioned again for the entire chapter. So Watson, despite being crazy in love and really conflicted, he's pretty able to compartmentalize. He drops her off at 1 a.m. and off he goes.
Well, so, I just want to mention, this seems to be Mary's trope throughout this story.
Definitely.
She shows up and they immediately leave her.
Now, so as he's riding in the cab alone at 1 a.m., he starts to think through the mystery and he's like, wow, this mystery is complicated. He's reminding the reader, don't forget, it's been a month since we read the last chapter. He says, the Indian treasure, the curious plan found among Morrison's baggage, the strange scene at Major Sholto's death, the rediscovery of the treasure, immediately followed by the murder of the discoverer, the very singular accompaniments to the crime, the footsteps, the remarkable weapons, the words upon the card, corresponding with these upon Captain Morrison's chart. Here was indeed a labyrinth in which a man less singularly endowed than my fellow lodger might well despair of ever finding the clue. So what he's doing here is he's giving us the 8 or 9 elements of the case, just as a quick reminder, it's very complicated. And then he's saying, but no worries, Sherlock Holmes is on the case.
And again, Doyle's really good at marketing. And this is absolutely the superhero that we need is Mr. Sherlock Holmes. He's ready for this. And the doubt is certainly something that we have as readers because we are very confused. And Watson being that mirror for us, he's confused by all of the remarkable parts of this case. But he's really sure about his friend who will solve the case.
Absolutely.
We get to Mr. Sherman, who is never given a first name. This is one of Doyle's best side characters. I love when Doyle gives us these weird, awkward moments with these strange characters. He spells out who this person is in such a short amount of time. And I would love to see a spinoff. I'm sure that there's some fan fiction of Mr. Sherman and his menagerie.
And Steve, you always love a menagerie. And that's part of the reason I think you love Mr. Sherman so much.
I love the unusual case of the apartment full of animals. There is no doubt about that. And I love having them separate from me.
Keep clear of the badger, Steve. Keep clear of the badger.
We don't need no stinking badgers.
This guy is hilarious. And the other beauty of this, Holmes has a relationship with this guy, and Watson has no idea that this is, no idea. All of a sudden, Mr. Sherman. I'm like, I've never heard of Mr. Sherman before. What are you hiding from me again?
Right. So remember, Holmes sent Watson to collect a queer mongrel with a most amazing power of scent. I would rather have Toby's help than the whole detective force of London, Holmes said when he sent Watson to collect Toby, this dog.
What? Ooh.
And it's also, let's not forget, it's 1 a.m, right? And so Watson just walks up and knocks on the door. And, you know, he had to knock for some time.
as one is apt to do. No,
when there's a mystery afoot, yeah. I had to knock for some time at number 3 before I could make my impression. At last, however, there was a glint of a candle behind the blind and a face looked out from an upper window. Mr. Sherman opens the window and says, "Go on, you drunken vagabond," said the face. "If you kick up any more row, I'll open the kennels and let out 43 dogs upon you." Watson replies, "If you let one out, it's just what I've come for." That's what I want. I want you to let out one dog. "Mr. Sherlock Holmes," I began, but the words had the most magical effect, for the window instantly slammed down, and within a minute, the door was unbarred and opened. Mr. Sherman was a lanky, lean old man with stooping shoulders and a stringy neck and blue-tinted glasses. There you go. I need to get...
Dick Van Dyke, or is this Billy Crystal, Steve?
I'm thinking this is more of a Dr. Jacoby from Twin Peaks, played by Russ Tamblyn from the West Side Story musical. Because yes,
of course,
yeah, the blue tinted glasses is really the sign of a weird character, right? That's shorthand.
Well, it's nighttime.
At 1 o'clock in the morning, he's wearing sunglasses. 106 miles to Chicago, we have a pack of gas, half a pack of cigarettes, it's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses. Hit it.
And then his conversation from there is even better. "A friend of Mr. Sherlock is always welcome," said he. "Step in, sir. Keep clear of the badger, for he bites. Ah, naughty, naughty, would you take a nip at the gentleman?" This to a stoat, which thrust its wicked head and red eyes between the bars of its cage. "Don't mind that, sir. It's only a slow worm. It ain't got no fangs, so I give it the run of the room, for it keeps the beetles down. You must not mind my being just a little short with you at first, for I'm guyed at by the children, and there's many a one just comes down this lane to knock me up. What was it that Mr. Sherlock Holmes wanted, sir?" And so, like, the so this poor guy, right?
He's, oh my God,
somewhat amused by the neighborhood children.
Just this one quick... this one quick paragraph, and you get everything you need to know about this guy. There's a badger that bites, there's a stoat that just walks around with beady red eyes, and the children come knocking on his door just to mess with this guy. That's a great character. Watson asks about Toby, because that's what he came for, and Mr. Sherman says, "Toby lives at number 7 on the left here."
It's like they all have their little apartments, you know?
Little numbered cages. He lives at number 7. Right. It's hilarious.
Over here!
He moved slowly with his candle among the queer animal family which he had gathered around him. In the uncertain, shadowy light, I could see dimly that there were glancing, glimmering eyes peeping down at us from every cranny and corner. Even the rafters above our heads were lined with solemn fowls who lazily shifted their weight from one leg to the other as our voices disturbed their slumbers. Oh my God. God, this is an amazing scene. Thank you, Doyle.
Best.
This is totally Lemony Snicket type of area.
Yes. That's not exactly gothic, right? That is a different thing.
No, there's a humor because this person has so many animals in this little tinny place. It's and so they all ridiculous. Have they're all, I don't know, it's kind of Harry Potter-ish too, in the sense that you are the person that has the animals. And it doesn't just have a single animal. It's like Steve's house. There's like a pride of animals.
It's full.
Right. And then we meet Toby, the famous Toby. And so the description of Toby is pretty great too. Toby proved to be an ugly, long-haired, lop-eared creature, half spaniel and half lurcher, brown and white in color, with a very clumsy, waddling gait. And I love that he's half spaniel and half lurcher, because lurcher is already a mixed breed. And so instead of just being like, he's a mutt. But we kind of get that feeling from Toby that he has his skills are all on the inside.
Well, certainly this is a comical looking dog. I just replaced this dog with Scooby-Doo in my mind.
I've
been
that.
Trying to do Scooby-Doo all this moment, but the point is that, you know, later on he will become Scooby-Doo or the descendant of this dog.
I love Scooby-Doo. This is definitely when we get to the scene, we haven't gotten there yet, where they're walking with Toby, Holmes and Watson and Scooby-Doo, and I can just imagine the background going back and forth, just the same background over and over again, and it makes me happy.
I can see that, definitely.
So it is a waddling mutt, but we'll just call it Scooby-Doo.
Yeah. Sherlock is happy to see Toby. Holmes brings Watson up to date. He says, Athenley Jones has gone. We have had an immense display of energy since you left. He has arrested not only friend Thaddeus, but the gatekeeper, the housekeeper, and the Indian servant. We have the place to ourselves, but for a sergeant upstairs.
And don't you feel like Holmes is like, great, he's arrested everybody. We got free reign. We can look at everything we want. He's not like concerned about these people being unjustly arrested.
It's like 3 a.m. and, oh my God. He's like in the house by himself, you know, just hanging out. And let's go mess around with the crime scene.
All the evidence. Totally. And then the mystery deepens. Now, I actually have a really nice Penguin Classics edition of The Sign of Four. And I was really especially grateful for the footnotes in this passage. So there's this moment where Holmes is chatting with the police sergeant who has been left upstairs. Lend me your bullseye, sergeant, said my companion. Now tie this bit of card round my neck so as to hang it in front of me. I have two footnotes there. One of them says that the bullseye is a lantern. Did you guys know that?
I didn't. No idea.
And then the other footnote said that Doyle's handwriting, it was really hard to tell his A's from his O's. And so this is a mistake in the canon. He presumably meant to tie a bit of cord around his neck, not a bit of card around his neck. But it's a mistake that was made in the original printing. And so it's made forever. Exactly.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think that's sort of, those are the little funny details that I always enjoy reading about.
Holmes wants Watson to take special notice that the toes on a footprint are distinctly divided. Bear that in mind, he says.
Very helpful to the reader as well as to Watson.
Yeah, so that says something. That led me to a thought. I will not. I put it in the notes, but I don't want to give a spoiler. I don't know if it's true, though, because I haven't read ahead.
Isn't that interesting that we can't give any of our, we are certainly in this mystery. We are certainly trying to solve this. But if we say what our theories are, they might be spoilers for this daily podcast. Interesting theory, Mr. Hessenflow.
That's right.
Doesn't flow like Watson.
Great babe.
So after giving us that note about the footprint, Holmes keeps reading the scene. That is where he put his foot in getting out. If you can trace him, and that's italicized for poor Watson. If you can trace him, I should think Toby will have no difficulty. If you can do it, a dog is going to be right there. Now run downstairs, loose the dog, and look out for Blondin. And Blondin is a famous French acrobat who crossed Niagara Falls on a tightrope. So I think Holmes here is really giving us another clue that there was that 60-foot climbing of the wall, right? So the way the scene is set up, you got to have someone quite athletic, even acrobatic, to be able to accomplish what's been accomplished.
Well, that even cements my theory even more. I missed this when I was reading it. And as you're telling it to me, well, I think we figured out what happened.
Mm-hmm.
You've got some ideas.
I'm no Watson.
I say nothing. I have read this before.
They take a big, long 6-mile walk at 3 o'clock in the morning. Good for them.
That's like 12,000 steps, Steve.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it is.
This is my exercise for the day, reading this chapter. Holmes is solicitous of Watson. Are you game for a 6-mile trudge, Watson? Certainly, I answered. Your leg will stand it? Oh, yes. Don't worry about the leg. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. It's
fine. Do you have your Fitbit set? Let's go. Come on.
Holmes shares some of his reasoning as they follow Toby through the night and towards daybreak. Sherlock figures Jonathan Small wouldn't have killed Brother Bartholomew. He did not wish to put his head in a halter. There was no help for it, however. The savage instincts of his companion had broken out, and the poison had done its work. So Jonathan Small left his record, lowered the treasure box to the ground, and followed it himself. Interesting theory.
And so on this long walk, Holmes seems to have like a pretty good sense of the case. And then he also expounds on the German philosopher, John Paul Richter. And he asks Watson, you know Richter, right? And Watson's like, sure I do. So then Holmes says, he makes one curious but profound remark. It is that the chief proof of man's real greatness lies in his perception of his own smallness. It argues, you see, a power of comparison and of appreciation, which is in itself a proof of nobility. There is much food for thought in Richter. You have not a pistol, have you? Now, I kind of love that scene because that idea that one of the greatest things about human perception is the ability to see how tiny we are in the great scheme of things and of space, how small we are in the galaxy, and also how tiny we are when we think about all the people who have lived and died before us and will live and die after us. It's kind of one of those walking with your friend and your favorite dog at 4 a.m. kind of thoughts. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. How big this case is and how small it is compared to the rest of existence. Yeah.
Anyway, and then he gets jarred right back into place. Hey, after having this deep conversation, hey, do you have your gun?
Exactly. That's what I think is really great about it. How Sherlock compartmentalizes, right? Ba-bam.
But didn't we already have a, do you have a gun?
We did.
Line in this?
Yep. Sherlock has one, Watson does not.
That's yeah. Sherlock has one in his jacket pocket. Uh-huh. Yeah, it has a couple shots ready for him.
Yeah.
That seems like the right place to carry it, Steve.
Yeah, it's fine. Welcome to Chicago.
Which brings us to the end of the chapter and finally the barrel of the title, since this chapter is the episode of the barrel. So Toby hesitates as he's following the creosote scent and he's like kind of confused, and then he gets excited and heads in one direction and they end up at a barrel heavy with the smell of creosote. And so obviously Toby's gone the wrong way. And the final line of the chapter, Sherlock Holmes and I looked blankly at each other and then burst simultaneously into an uncontrollable fit of laughter. The end. And I think this might be the first time we've left a chapter with like uncontrolled hysterical laughter from Holmes and Watson. Does that sound right to you guys?
Mm-hmm. Well, they're in a barrel and that's so funny.
Right? Well, the funny part was the dog lost the scent at one point and looked around and around and around, and it was very comical that the dog could not pick up the scent and then suddenly he did pick up that scent.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Which leads to Chip's theory of what kind of story we're talking about here that we'll probably get to next chapter.
Right.
A barrel of monkeys, Steve. A barrel of monkeys.
Ew.
This place.
The next chapter, chapter 8, is called The Baker Street Irregulars. And I love The Baker Street Irregulars, so I'm looking forward to that one a lot.
So we'll have another group of kids that Holmes knows about, but you know, Watson may not be aware of.
We look forward to that. Chapter 8 will definitely be a fun chapter. This was a fun chapter, too. We've got some fun stuff, some fun characters. I hope everybody out there is enjoying it just as much as we are. Hopefully, we're not talking more than the length of the chapter of this episode.
We're close.
But this is great. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text, send us an email, or follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes for all the feedback from around the world. And go to our dedicated Sherlock Holmes website, Sandwiches at Irregular Hours.com, for all of these fun conversations that we've had for 3 months now. Wow, we've been doing this a long time. Join us tomorrow for Chapter 8. We'll find more information about the Baker Street Irregulars. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflug.
And I'm Pam Bedard.
Wait, where's Brother Thaddeus in all of this?